Blog Talk Radio.
To have you sit in with us today. What's this? I'm moving into the excitement of the autumnal equinox. Aren't we? Of course, around the world. Down up there in the south, you're moving toward summer, and up here in the north, we're moving toward winter. Everything is as it should be. And I'm sitting here with an espresso that is fine, and I hope you're doing the same. And for those who are not as experienced, if you're like me, you haven't experienced the entire world. And just let it be known, there's listeners in Southeast Asia here, there's and over on that important remarkable culture in New Zealand, we have listeners tuning in. It's a pleasure. Up in the Netherlands, hello, and Latvia, a pleasure. You know, it's wonderful to have you sit in, and particularly Ireland. I'm very happy to have listeners from Ireland as well as the UK and Canada and Turkey and where else? Oman, so South Sudan. Yeah. Even in these places where there's strife, you know, there's the environment is getting our attention. Here's a bit of a shock, you know, and nature prevails. Many of us, and I include myself in this one, this statement, are rethinking this notion of man's dominance over nature. I know. You're going to say it was taught to us in scripture. Yes, yes, yes. But I don't think it's for me and many like me. It's proving valid because we don't have. If we don't dominate, that's not domination or whatever it is. Nature doesn't seem to be cowed by us or obedient or be following our clamor to use everything about nature as a commodity, as a raw material to be reformed. Well, all of that, we've been doing that for a long, long, long time. We, humanity. So for, I know people who will talk to me and say, I didn't do that. I'm not responsible. That was other generations. But we're breathing. We are what we are. And there's no denying that we aren't alone on this blue rock floating in the darkness, and that we understand the fragility of conditions that led to this, I call it a miracle, this special creature that developed out of all of this, you and I. So within our skin, these systems are so incredibly coordinated and complicated. They're beautiful, beautiful chemistry and biology, physiology, and thought, consciousness. That's all. I don't understand this for a moment. And you can have a better chance of explaining how loops work in time space than explaining how consciousness occurred. And it does. It does. Babies are born, and almost indescribable. We, in our own clumsy way, we've wondered at it and tried to replicate it, and we can put together different combinations of things, but we still don't understand that that potential, that they, how is that potential arrived at from a cluster of cells, you and I. So there's lots for the likes of me, and I tend to think for a lot of you, that we wade through the mess after opening up Pandora's box. We have this mess around us, but at the bottom, remember, hope springs eternal. It's there. We can lose a lot of things. We can lose a lot. We can give up a lot, but not hope. No, not hope. So I'm hopeful that we won't come to a common understanding about the importance of nature around us, but nature will teach us, and it will keep repeating the lessons patiently until we begin to get it, and until we begin to understand. It's not necessarily going to be pleasant. I mean, it's not negotiable. But it is what it is. It's generations on. Some things have never lost relevance. Unusual. We've heard tales from the sailors about this calm conditions. You're moving along, and there's this rogue wave. That is hard to describe. Where did it come from? It just is. Well, when you're in the throes of it and it's tossing your little craft around, it doesn't really matter where it's come from. It's more a matter of what you're going to do about it. We still have the planets are still moving around us. The stars are moving. Our star is still generating a great deal of heat for us and light, and the universe remains in balance, even with this the messiness that we've perpetrated, learning how to come to terms with the greatness of, and I think in a way it's restoring a message that our ancestors knew, and it's so I think so unusual in a way and refreshing. Once you and I were connected with nature, and we look at it at arm's length and talk about the superstitions that went with it, that we would make sacrifices, that we would have celebrations, that we were far, far more in touch with the phenomena going on around us. And then different belief systems were taught, and very powerful belief systems. And some of them have lost something in the translation through time. You make of that as you need. For some, these words are meaningless. For others, they're a connection. You understand. But what seems to be occurring, what's been prevalent, although we've been walking, we tend to put blindfolds on about it, is the power and integrity of nature. Never lets us down. It's patient. You know, if we're going to watch, if we're thinking about our impatience, we need to study the patience of the mountain, high mountain ranges being ground down by weather, and ocean levels that they weren't always this level. They were lower at one point and higher at others, and land masses that continue to shift. Even when we experiment drilling little holes into the ground to extract oil and gas, of course the Earth's surface is going to, this mantle is going to resettle, and it's going to take us along with it. There's no question. What has that done to the water tables, the aquifers? One can only imagine. One can only imagine. And do we see ourselves as part of that whole system? Well, not entirely. No, a lot of us have been convinced that we're above that. And so nature is repeating itself, continuously showing us, teaching these very small, powerless little creatures. If you think the horrors that we came up with in the Second World War, just to incinerate people on a large scale with big bombs, is power. Well, you and I know that shrinks by comparison with meteor strikes or the power of tornadoes or or lightning. We want to talk about energy. It's remarkable, and we seem to be, well, at least where I am, there's been a revisit of old beliefs. Maybe you'll say, well, that means that we're cycling through. We're cycling back to to earlier understanding. Well, truth be known, there's a great deal of science in the past that we tend to overlook and say, well, it wasn't modern, so it couldn't have been very clever or accurate. Well, there's some surprises out there. I'm not here to be a shill for all of those surprises. You can look for yourself. There's some things that are hard to understand. How do we have that kind of imagery or technology that tells us about circuitry and things that are more commonplace today, but from records of thousands of years old? Well, you've often heard me say on this program that I think that you and I are very similar to the people that wrote and thought decent people like us, and wished to explore what could happen if we were able to coordinate, if we took all of our talents together, what could we produce? Well, we find that we produce awful things and harm. We can continue and people can exploit our sense of competition. But what's irrepressible is this desire for compromise and coordination, because some people would say any kind of compromise is a failing, and other people will say, yeah, that's necessary because our vision is a little bigger than what we can see at the end of our nose. We're thinking about the harmonics around and the possibility of a life with that kind, those kind of harmonics. Well, we created whole countries, nations around those kind of ideas. We get on the same page and we work together and we accept certain governance and we just begin to define fairness and we create laws that help us when people go off track for all kinds of reasons. And it endures. Some of this endures. And yet, there is still, and I think we can recognize, a fear of tolerance that's exploited, a fear of tolerance, because it raises, and it's not put very fairly. It's addressed to us as individuals to think about what will happen, what could possibly happen if these tolerances were to continue. Well, what would happen is a different kind of truth. And what would happen is a realization that we don't really control it. We live it. We live with certain fundamental truths. Does an honest man, for example, does an honest man need the law to tell him the difference between right and wrong? Do you need the potential for a policeman to charge you in order to live an honest life? Well, not to embarrass, not to say we don't need them. They're unnecessary. Of course they're necessary. Of course. We need to have order and we need to have law, all in good proportion, because we also have created, we have been sensible enough that we know that those things aren't enough, that we needed this whole, we needed to create judges that are beyond the fray. And we decided that it was more important to let a guilty man go free than it was to incarcerate a man falsely. Bitter, eh? Bitter, but based on ethics. Yep. The world around us is going to be reminding us about what's massively important and what we don't control. But now we have we'll have opportunities, and some nations in Europe are champions in this, taking in these refugees. There's millions of people. I don't know how I could continue on and offer you any kind of thoughtful comment of a Masonic flavor without talking about the obvious things that are happening around us. Whole generations, whole groups of people are moving, are having to move, not just because of despotism and now drought and water shortage and shortage of food. People are moving toward the better life. A place where life is sustainable. Now, we've known about this for a long time. We should not be shocked. If our academics, we the information is not state secret. It's just shared widely by a group that we call academics, which means them, not us. Well, there's them is us. Them is a part of us. We've known these things for a long time, but what we do about it, huh? Knowing that you're a fool doesn't make you a champ, because standing up in a chair and saying, there, I cleanse my conscience. I've declared to the world that I'm a complete fool. No. What are you going to do about it? You know, you've simply declared what all of us have known when we're in your presence. You do foolish things. You sound like a fool. You're rash. And now you're saying, I've finally figured it out. There, I'm a whole again. Nope. What are you going to do about it? What do you do now when a fool realizes that there's a freedom to being a fool? You know, you're not inhibited by convention. But an unaware fool is a risk not only to himself, but to everything around him. And now we seem to be saying, making this declaration in front of nature. Yeah, we've done some really, really foolish things. What can we do now? Well, we don't look to nature for the answer. We're looking to each other to help us understand what nature needs. How can we facilitate instead of aggravate? I don't have simple answers to this. You listen to people call in. My message is on my phone and I'm not available. It's asking for help to understand physics. There's theories I just have a hard time wrestling with. So, hey, leave the message. Give me the tip. Tell me how it works. String theory, how does that work? I understand, I understand where it is finally, but these theories, I hope we find, theoretically, I hope we find some path forward, some of the mathematics that we can rely on, something factual. In the meantime, we're amazed, and in all of that, there is that celebration that we come together between us while all of this is going on, is this capacity, this undeniable capacity to be quite real, to be tolerant, to be benevolent, to help one another. In other words, to begin the creation of culture. How would anybody ever attempt that? To want to be associated with this group that have their own way of thinking, their own way of being, their own uniqueness. Well, it's happening. It's happening. And all the time, all the while, we look out the window and we'll feel the weather on our face. And now it's reminding us of what our children have been crying about, the climate. What have we been doing about it? Well, we haven't been respecting it. And many of the next generations are, and they're looking for belief systems that reflect that. And there are belief systems. Don't think that I'm just saying we have to get rid of all of the so-called orthodoxy that's out there. No. But the search goes on, and you'll find that there's cultures that, if you study a little bit about, there's some buzzwords, trigger words that just upset the world, so I'm trying to not use them. But through our history, we know there are practices and faiths that evolved. But to think that they disappeared would be a mistake. They didn't disappear. Nature is bringing the importance back to us, and it's pretty interesting. The good program today, the poetry, a sonnet, Sonnet 75 by Edmund Spenser. Beautiful piece of work. And again, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what a poetry does, that texture, that sense of the description, the use of language to dive into the often unseen condition. The commentary, these things called changes, I think you'll like it. I enjoyed writing it. To start this off, we have a little Clifford Brown and Max Roach. It's really, really very cool. From 1954. I'm sure that's well before some of you were born, but I remember 1954. Delilah. Thank you. That'll do, I'd say. Max Roach and Clifford Brown. Smoking. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful music. These things called changes. Wonder what was on my mind when I wrote this. We could look around us and claim what we see and experience indicates decline. We could, and many do, that include the disillusioned, discouraged, the disenfranchised. Dreamers and idealists will be visited by realists. And who could argue? Except, is it possible the strength of this point of view might be illusion? Whether it is or isn't, how are we to know? Apart from that, we would need some reason to invest our thinking in a point of view. Apart from that, we would need some reason to invest our thinking in that enterprise. So what? Who would be inconvenienced one way or the other? Decline. Does it truly matter that we know the truth? Who's to say it isn't one qualified opinion in a world of continuous opinions, all on a spectrum that reduces opposition to shades of gray? At some point, the extreme edge of one meets the extreme edge of the other. When we speak about opposites, or for some of you, duality, it is us speaking about stereotypes for the purpose of slowing down the vibration temporarily to let us observe more closely. Stereotypes serve a purpose. It isn't a problem until we ascribe causality. That A plus B equals C, when all we really have is A equals B equals C. I suspect we are of the same mind as were those who elevated thinking. Maybe we should read Jan Comenius or know who was Abu Bakr Muhammad ibn Zakari al-Reza. But we're tribal as they were. It puts what we and they are thinking and saying in a broader context. Whose truth are we talking about? The one that applies narrowly or the one that might be distant but more accurate? The logic and knowledge of those involved might be self-serving or malevolent, or it could be what seemed right at the time. The greater truth, if there is ultimate truth, will be the measure that matters in the long run. But today, optics matter. How we get there? What we strive for. Getting there. We call it change. How is it change? It's like calling an accident news. I don't mean to be dispassionate, too much of that. No. It can empathize, but some things, some events hurt more than others. Because life goes on, mine and yours and everybody around. And even when we slow down to take a look at the accidents, for what purpose? None. That I can see. But slow down we must. Here, this is Miles Davis helping us to slow down. Let me tell you about a 16th century poet, Edmund Spenser. Why Spenser? Why is it important? Well, the big scheme of things, is detail important? Is there such a thing as metaphysics? Is there metaphor? Does that? I don't know. Sometimes there is. Sometimes there isn't. It depends, eh? Do I want to think metaphorically when I'm, working in a field or cutting wood? not necessarily, but I can. If somebody asks me, and if you're taking out a thermos of cool water. On a hot day, I can sit there and think about it. Or maybe when I'm eating a sandwich and having an apple, I can entertain myself by pulling a small book of poetry out of my pocket. Oh, you think that didn't happen? Yeah, we just did a lot of things without bringing attention. There was a time when we weren't prone to taking pictures of our breakfast, thinking that somebody else would be interested. Oh my, yeah. This is a little known about this guy, Spencer. He was related to a noble Midlands family of Spencer, but they made their money through raising sheep. But he wasn't well. His own family, they weren't wealthy, but they made do. We know this because he was entered as a recorded in the records of the Merchant Taylor's Grammar School as a poor boy. Now, understand that he would have been studying, mainly he would have been studying Latin and some Hebrew and Greek and music. Just think about the topics. Eh? 1569, he was about 16 years old. His English versions of poems by the 16th century French poet Joachim du Bella and his translation of a French version of a poem by the Italian poet Petrarch appeared at the beginning of an anti-Catholic prose tract, a theater of voluptuous worldlings. They were no doubt commissioned by its chief author, the wealthy Flemish expatriate Jan Baptista van der Noot. Some of these poems Spencer later revised for and did up in a volume that he called Complaints. Anyway, through he prevailed. He had to leave certain places because of epidemics. You know, he left Cambridge because of epidemic, 1574. But he took his master's, got his master's in 1576, 3 years later. He is known, we know that he associated with some people, Gabriel Harvey at Cambridge. And we also know about his period, he was acquiring a great deal of knowledge, not only about Latin and Greek, but also Italian and French and English literature. So I'm going to just, his religious training was important part of his education. He couldn't avoid it with the struggles going on in his university over the path, the new path of the Church of England. Can you imagine? He had to tread between Roman Catholicism and this extreme Puritanism. Well, it's funny, you know, funny, ha ha, funny, not so ha ha. We have the community that was formed on this extremism turned into a nation, sort of turning on itself now. He has a poem. If you're looking through, you're Googling it, you'll see his most he's renowned for a particular poem, The Fairy Queen, F-A-E-R-I-E. Now, what I like about this guy's work is this. He was using language that was arcane even at the time. It was old-fashioned, even in the late 16th century. He was dragging back words into the language that had fallen out of use, or he was inventing words that sounded as if they had. So he had to supply glossaries to his own poetry. You know, what do these things mean? It surely is nothing to say to us as we go boldly into the glorious future. But even if he hadn't, there would be reason enough to recommend him. We are in a horrible thrall of contemporaneity to relevance. And to find something that's escaped the attention of dimwit and craven modernizers, oh, what an analysis, is reason enough to celebrate it. We escaped this. Why talk down? But the funny thing is there's some works that are always going to be relevant in small, unforeseen ways. And before we get into that, I should like to say that one of the great things going on in his book that we're drawing on isn't that of the Fairy Queen. It's notable. And decided, you know, you'd have to work around it. It's still a gap in the reading. There's so much more, and he adds to it. Get this. This is the sort of the summary about this sonnet. You know, these 14 lines. One day I wrote my beloved's name in the sand of the shore. I just, don't you love that imagery?
Yeah. And have you done that? You're going to write your secrets or your passions. But the waves rolled in and erased it. So I wrote it a second time. But when the tide came in, it just ate up all of my work again. There, you're being silly and prideful, my beloved told me, in your futile attempts to make something mortal last forever. I'm going to die and decay one day, and just as the ocean erases my name from the shore, everything about me will disappear. That's not true, he argued. Less noble things can plan to die and disappear, but you're going to live forever through fame. My poetry will immortalize your incredible goodness and write your magnificent name in the heavens. Even when death has come for the entire world, our love will live forever. Well, this is a poem. This is a sonnet about the power of poetry itself. The poem's speaker wants his beloved to be remembered forever, even as she argues that such notions are vain and pointless. She's a human being, and as such, her name and memory will one day disappear along with her mortal body. But the speaker believes that her beauty and virtue deserve everlasting fame, and that he has the ability to immortalize her, to grant her a kind of triumph over death through his poetry. But despite the speaker's deep admiration for his beloved, the poem makes it clear that she is subject to the inevitable passage of time. The fact that the speaker repeatedly writes his beloved's name upon the strand or the shore, only for the ocean to quickly wash it away, suggests that time's passage is relentless. The image of her name disappearing from the strand also suggests how fleeting people's marks are upon the world. After her death, time will remove all proof of her ever having lived. But the speaker acknowledges that lesser mortal things will indeed die and all traces of them will disappear, but he insists that his beloved's admirable and virtuous name deserves to live forever, and that it will through his poetry. Here, you decide. Does she live? One day I wrote her name upon the strand. But came the waves and washed it away. Again I wrote it with a second hand, but came the tide and made my pains his prey. Vain man, she said, thou dost in vain essay, a mortal thing so to immortalize, for I myself shall like to this decay, and eke my name be wiped out likewise. Not so, quod I, let baser things devise to die in dust, but you shall live by fame. My verse, your virtues rare, shall eternize. And in the heavens write your glorious name, where, when as death shall all the world subdue, our love shall live and later life renew. What do you think? Is the message in the poetry itself? That poetry captures experiences and immortalizes them. That you and I are here but for a short time. And that one day I wrote her name upon the strand, but came the waves and washed it away. Maybe the name is mine and it's me that time is washing away. Yeah. Entirely reasonable. Here's a little Bill Evans. Title of this tune is Some Other Time. Yeah, I know. No pun intended. Here I'm going to begin to talk more about the culture that is only artificial to people that find it irrelevant, like our exposure to other cultures around the world. Some have this sense that only theirs is supreme because it's theirs. You know, you've met the type. And then others that are curious and want to explore different scents, different spices, different music, different occasion, different values. because the more we, the thinking is, the more we learn about other people, the more we learn about ourselves. But along that way, we are exposed to the views and the thinking of other people that tell us more about ourselves than we often care to know. But it's necessary, I think, in order to grow. Here, in this section, you believe it, this is history, and we're moving through 18th century stuff, as you know. You know, we've been talking about the struggles around and concerns about nationalism that have to do with the period of in the Netherlands. In the bigger scheme of things, we're looking at the impact, the alleged impact of British Freemasonry and on the continent and Europe. Here, the possessions, this, we begin more and more to talk about, think about in the back of your mind as I'm going through this, about the culture. We've identified this culture as something that appeals to us because of characteristics of the culture. But we find that it's not as easy as just throwing your hands in the air or buying a ticket and saying, there, you know, just rid me of all that I need and impart all this knowledge. No, it's because it doesn't work that way, because it's life. It's what we do, not when we're with one another in our lodges, but what we do with our values and principles when we're going through our life in general. The possession of secret signs delineated the righteous or separated believers from the world. Masonic fraternalism always possessed a moral dimension. And among the most fundamental moral imperatives of early modern European society have been the rights and duties of the father. Patriarchal authority was taken, certainly by men, to be the basis of all order in society and government. Imagine that. Masonic fraternalism built upon that presumed truth, incorporating thereby gender as absolutely fundamental to determining who might be permitted to join the new fraternity. Bit uncomfortable for us to think that way, but almost invariably, Masonic usage throughout Europe after mid-century also implied that the profane were not simply going about their business, however prejudiced and uninspired it may have been. Rather, they were watching the brothers, commenting upon them, even condemning them. Yet, in general terms, this hostility did not prevent the brothers from courting the profane. A popular French Masonic song enticed the profane, "Less strange than zealous, come, you can join with us." Yet despite the courtship, the condemnation of the profane increasingly identified them with the commonality of men and, at least in theory, all women. Increasingly, the profane came to mean the vile populace, the superstitious and uneducated, who thwart the fruits of Masonic labor. Against the indiscreet attention of the profane, the Freemason has no protection except, although scorned, the profane were frequently addressed by Masonic orators as if they were present. Profanes, open your eyes, leave your lethargy. The times have come to embrace the cause of virtue, to renounce error, to escape the yoke of prejudice, of which you have been for a long time slaves and victims. Being profane became a Masonic discourse, a state of mind, as well as a social category. To pass out of the category of the profane required, therefore, special circumstances. In theory, any man could be a Freemason. As Rousset de Messie put it in a letter to his close friend, "We are friends to all the world," but then he added, "except to the Jesuits, whom not one master of a lodge would receive in our order." The constitutions, you know, Preston's the second one. Then 1723, you know, that's the first one, demanded literacy and excluded women and bondsmen, who were largely servants. Moreover, every lodge imposed initiation fees and then regular dues. A rite of initiation was also required, which presumed the prior approval of a vast majority of brothers. Until the moment of that approval, the candidate seeking admission was called significantly a profane. He both literally and symbolically knocked upon the door of the lodge and sought the permission of its brothers to enter. This term was used in every initiation ritual to be found in every European country. Until the moment of admission, the candidate was a profane. In some sense, the profane lurked in every brother. Only the power of his ritual initiation into the brotherhood freed him from its influence. Much different today. Who are we preaching to? You've heard people proselytizing. You've heard that. So have I. I heard one not long ago. All fire and brimstone, you know, evangelical tents are preaching. Fear of the great unknown, fear of the creator. It's a version, but I tend to think people like us are looking for more. They're looking for ways to understand, to feel more at ease, to feel safe, to be able to feel that they are doing something meaningful that is recognized and supported by other people. And yet, it doesn't mean that this belief system that we share, we allegedly share, not all of us do, unfortunately, but that this belief system will endure. Edmund Spencer was right in that respect. The men that created this are long gone, although there's efforts by our structures to keep certain names alive as if they're more important than the message, but they're not. What's more important than the person is the message, the information. That the genius is being moved forward. Is it ascribed? Is it only important because I can ascribe it to an author? Well, I don't know if any of the folks were extrapolating, taking work from their, and I hope that they were drawing on their lessons. They were drawing on, they were extrapolating. They had been inspired by the work and the history of the Greeks, and they were inspired by the writings in Latin and Hebrew, and that they were consolidating that thinking into something noble, something approachable. Not only that we could sit with our candle and read this material and take a particular message from it, but this culture that you and I are in is based on the idea that people can share that. What is it? Surprise? That opening? That realization? And that by doing that, let's see. What happens if you and I open ourselves to tolerance and say, well, it doesn't matter. The form of your belief isn't as important as the fact that you believe. And then just the curiosity, without being able to predict this, what could we do if we put, let's say, well, listen, I'll have this conversation with you now, but we're not going to share this with anybody, right? What would happen if we organize ourselves. So all the people that thought that way, that had some sense of inspiration, had that, what do you call it, ability, opportunity, interest, whatever it is, need, we put them together. What do you think would happen? Well, geez, you know, right off the top, I think, well, probably great things, probably interesting things. Would it be simple? Well, no, you know, it takes work. And is everybody able to do that? Well, I think in some sense, there's people that set their minds to doing something and refining their skills at an early age for reasons that we can't replicate. You know, is it parenting? Well, if that was the case, we wouldn't have things like Edmund Spencer's. It's maybe it's the struggle. Well, for some of us, I know personally, that's the struggle is an important part of it. For others, it's being born to advantage. How you get there seems to be a test of the means in the end. Does it matter how we get there? Well, let's think that we move through this life and we have acted with some degree of ethics. Well, does that mean that the standards, if you're absorbing and becoming much more aware about ethics now, that you use that as the judgment for your behavior at an earlier age when you were naive, ignorant, or inexperienced? Let's call it all of that. Well, at some point, we could say, you know the difference between right and wrong. I'd like to be able to be that pious. Except I've been in situations and met people where survival was, you did what you had to do to survive. These folks lived and still are living with a tremendous amount of risk and danger.
Hmm.
Ethics, I like to think that we can, you know, we can resolve and rationalize what we're doing without losing something of our humanity. Easy to judge harshly, but we're encouraged not to do that, aren't we? Yeah, sure. We're encouraged by something referred to as Solomon. Yeah, the ideas that have been written, monotheism being what it is, these ideas have been passed down. The idea of understanding being very powerful. Well, sort of come full circle in this program today too, talking about understanding what's going on with the world around us and our place in the universe and what we need to do in order to survive. The task in our community is about in 7.5 billion people, not just you and me, not just the wealthy. Not going to work that way. Nature, because nature doesn't distinguish. Hurricane doesn't zip around somebody that's wealthy or somebody that's pious or somebody that's nice. No. It's subdues us in a way, or it impresses us with lessons. So learn. Learn one way or the other. This is Branford Massal, 1987. Thank you for tuning in today. I hope it's been helpful or interesting. Put some perspective on what's going on around us. So a lot of what we're talking about here continues to be with us today. How we define ourselves and how we look at the world around us. Easy to be harsh. Easy to think of what we do as escapism. It's easy. I wouldn't fault anybody. But still, we have an opportunity to experience something special and be part of that within the craft, the gentle craft. Thank you for tuning in. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And include yourself in that. Understanding is much more interesting, I think, than judgment. Yeah, I think so. No, go and prove me wrong. See you soon. Thank you.